With his 2015-2017 state budget proposal, Governor Scott Walker would overthrow Wisconsin's traditions of fair rules and effective services. The Madison Institute believes such changes deserve the attention of a well-informed citizenry, so we sponsored a series of four progressive roundtables to discuss the realities of the situation. We invited knowledgeable panelists and opportunities for discussion. The four areas include K-12 public education, the University of Wisconsin system, social services, and natural resources. Today's topic is K-12 public education. Our panelists are Tom McCarthy with the Department of Public Instruction, Dan Rossmiller at the Wisconsin Association of School Boards, and Julie Mead, UW-Madison School of Education. This talk was held on February 28, 2015, at the Madison Central Library in downtown Madison, Wisconsin. There are also downloadable handouts at our website at themadisoninstitute.org. First, we hear from Tom McCarthy at the Department of Public Instruction.
The basic essence of what we're about to talk about here is the challenges that are facing Wisconsin's K-12 school system. Things are changing more rapid than our policies and politics are reflecting. So we have a lot of different demographic shifts, changes in how education is provided to students, obviously changing on the educator side and the school organization side. So let's kick off by looking at some student demographic things. The change in poverty in the state of Wisconsin per each school district. Couple takeaways. First, you'll notice that 2001, the poverty rate for students in our state was 21%. Now, 21% means that of all the students in the state, 21% of them qualified for free or reduced price lunch, free and reduced price lunch. So free and reduced price lunch, again, before we jump and go through some of this other stuff, is based on the federal poverty level. And for a free lunch to qualify, you have to be at 133% of the federal poverty level. The level adjusts over time, so this adjusts with inflation. Despite that, you're still looking at, in 2012, 43% of our students qualifying for free and reduced price lunch. It's not an issue that's necessarily confined to Milwaukee or Dane County. It's something that is happening across the state, which explains how that jump goes in 10 years from 21% to 43%. So this is enrollment in school districts across the state. So a good takeaway for you is that enrollment decline is something that in the last decade has become a very real problem for school districts across the state. While not a necessarily confined phenomenon, decreasing enrollment is becoming more and more common among districts, which is causing the number of districts with enrollment under 1,000 students to increase over time. So now that we have current time here, 2012, we'll call it current time for this presentation, 75% of our students are located in 30% of the districts. So what's happening is this shrinking into a smaller amount of districts over time. So now, as poverty increases throughout our rural area school districts are also losing population. So the combined problem of dealing with not as many kids and the kids that are left in the schools being more impoverished than before is that funding becomes an incredibly important component to educate kids. You can't shut down a school, you can't necessarily shut down a class. If you have a first grader, you have to educate that first grader, okay? One of the other trends that we're seeing over time that is on a steady increase is the amount of homeless students that are showing up to our schools. I think it's an incredibly powerful thing when you look at that in about 10 years, we've tripled the amount of homeless students that are accessing our schools. However, on the other side, we're not really providing schools and districts the ability or the tools to actually address what a homeless student brings with them to the classroom. So I think part of this you can see reflected in the free and reduced price lunch stuff that we talked about before, but a homeless student brings a whole other set of issues and challenges to the classroom that a general free and reduced price lunch student doesn't. I'm sorry, I should go back and tell you too that half of Wisconsin's homeless kids can be found in just 10 school districts. Those are the urban districts of the state, but it's still an important takeaway that they are shouldering more of these students than the rest of the state. What do we know about poverty in academics? I'm sure you're all aware the Department of Public Instruction creates report cards that we provide to schools and districts. When we disaggregate those particular report cards and take a look at what happens when you control for poverty, we see this trend line happening here, which means that as your school gets more and more impoverished students, your overall score or accountability metric that we've created goes down. So what that tells us is that poverty is an important component of education, which is something I think everybody in this room and everybody around education research knows. But sometimes it's just drives home a point that those are real issues that those districts are facing. We can show it in a data plot. We can animate maps. But when you actually think about what a classroom teacher is experiencing when you increase the amount of impoverished students in your classroom and decrease the amount of kids and thereby resources you have to deal with them, this tends to propagate. It happens more. Poverty is an important component, but it is not the only component. Have any of you been following the state superintendent convened his Promoting Excellence for All task force, which was designed to look at Wisconsin's achievement gaps, mainly focused on our racial achievement gap. Wisconsin has right now the highest achievement gap between black and white students in the United States. So part of getting our hands around that was looking at the whys. Poverty obviously jumps out, but there's something else that goes on between impoverished students, white students, black students, students of color, that you can't explain the whole thing, okay? So one of the things that we looked at in doing this, we pulled together a bunch of schools and districts around the state that were succeeding in closing the gap, figured out what they were doing. A lot of the things that they were doing were kind of common sense things that you would expect. They were addressing the cultural sensitivity of their students. If you're a white teacher and you're teaching a class of color, you don't necessarily have the same exact conversations with them because they're on different playing fields as you are. So obviously this is a problem. I kind of wanted to talk about some of the good things, but it is one thing that goes into the complexity and challenges that our schools and districts face. So now we're into the meat and potatoes of some of the alternative government stuff. Vouchers and charters. I'm sure you guys have heard about both of these things. But one thing you might not have heard about is that despite their boom in the state of Wisconsin, 96% of our students still attend a publicly funded school. That does count our public charters, but those are funded in the exact same way that your public schools are, which means that if your public school doesn't have enough money to educate their general kids, they're likely going to be shortchanging their charter school kids that they're trying to set up as well. Voucher program, despite its 25 years of existence, still only accounts for about 26,000 kids. That number is still going up. It's around like 28 now. I think that's a 2012 figure. Over time, both the Wisconsin, Racine, and Milwaukee programs, as their voucher program has aged, more and more of the schools that are in the program become predominantly voucher kid schools. So that in Milwaukee now, you'll see the percentage of students in an average private school that participates in the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program has 79% of their students receiving a voucher. Now, I will tell you that that number also includes your traditional classic private schools like Milwaukee Marquette that accept around 10 to 15 students. So their percent is obviously incredibly low. So I think the big takeaway here is that the longer these voucher programs run, the longer they're in existence, the more their student population becomes dependent on the voucher. So what we're trying to say here, too, is that when you look at the population of these schools, they are subsidizing their students. I mean, that's probably the easiest and most clear-cut way. We are subsidizing their students, exactly. Yes. You, taxpayers, are paying for their kids. And it's becoming more and more like what you'd consider to be a public school because all of the students are receiving public funds. So the enrollment of Milwaukee is around 80,000 kids, give or take a year. They have massive fluctuations in how many there are. So you can count the roughly 22,000 kids compared to 80. So it's around like 80-ish percent of students in Milwaukee that are eligible and report. So we have problems because homeschooling is a tough thing for us to measure. So we look at traditional private and public, or traditional public, private, and voucher, and add those numbers together to get that percentage. And I would say Milwaukee sits at around 80. So it's not quite at the 96% number that I showed you on the last slide for the amount of students that access the public system, but that is about the best number I can give you. There's also a very high transferability, mobility rate in Milwaukee. So that's a snapshot in time thing. 2 days, 2 weeks down the line, those students very well might leave that private school and go back to Milwaukee. There's such a fluctuation between schools in Milwaukee that it's a very difficult thing for, well, obviously educators and school systems, but students as well.
Who keeps the money?
It depends on when they leave. It's the easiest way. It's prorated if they leave within account date, if they leave outside of account date. So there is an issue if they leave after the last count date in the year, there can be a lost funding source. And that more or less falls on Milwaukee. It does not fall on the private school. The private school will have to, will account for that lost time that the student didn't spend in the private school and reduce their payment. But Milwaukee doesn't necessarily get fairly compensated for having to educate that student from that point on. Yep. So that's the high school level math of the situation, is that it really does have a double impact or a sweeping impact on Milwaukee for a kid to leave the voucher program mid-year and come to Milwaukee. So the voucher program, gave you a little bit of background where they stand today. Some of you may have heard a term that was used by school choice advocate, that every student in the state should have a voucher in their backpack so they can go wherever they want, universal choice. Question always comes up, what does that cost, right? So this is a bit of a cost breakdown, transparently as possible, as an estimate of what that would cost the state. So we already know how many students receive a voucher right now. New cost for tuition paying vouchers takes the number of students that are left in private schools, the 93,000, multiplies it by the revenue limit, which is an important concept here. Right now, the voucher payment is less than the average expenditure for a state public school. That's a fact. That is not their end game goal. Their end game goal, as stated publicly on a number of occasions, is to be in a direct parity with public school spending. So this scenario assumes that they get their wish list, right? The voucher program gets their wish list. All 93,000 kids that are currently attending a private school are funded by the state at the parity level for public school students, which is around $10,000 a kid, which totals out to $930 million. That's 1 year, okay? To bring all of the private school students into parity with how much is spent on a public school, that's your bottom calculation. So the public school revenue limit, average, the voucher amount that they receive now, the difference in that, the enrollment in each program, to get you to another $77 million of marginal cost to bring the students who already receive a voucher into parity with public school students. You roll those two figures together and you've got the billion-dollar figure that you've heard about before. I apologize, I know there's math going on here. So in essence, what a voucher in every backpack that is in parity with how much we spend on public school students would cost the state an additional $1 billion per year. To give every kid a voucher who currently attends a private school, and then to bring parity on the expenditure level. So to take the voucher amount and continue to increase it until it is directly in line with the public school expenditure amount. So since we're all kind of diving into this, we're going to look at some finance information and back out at the most 100,000 foot level and talk about how schools are funded in the state of Wisconsin. Revenue limits are guided by state law. So when you hear about how much a district can spend, its revenue limit, revenue authority, that's where you start the equation. It's calculated based on how many kids you have, the cost that you educate those kids, and they were locked in when the formula was set back in 1993. State equalization aid, that's how much the state picks up of the cost for your education. So once you've already figured out how much you've spent, a formula comes along and says, like Dan said, you're going to get a rough average of around $5,000 a kid in state support that's going to offset your revenue limit. What's left is how much the property taxpayers pick up. Outside of the revenue limit are other things that you might hear about in school finance, categorical aids, aids that are targeted directly at assisting one particular thing. So you've got transportation aid, special education aid, sparsity aid, things that the state has felt it important enough to enshrine a particular program that allows a district to spend that money when they get it. Federal funds also, particular programs that the federal government requires us to run in our schools that they have decided that they're going to help us with. Now, I will tell you that their help in that regard is a little bit lower than even the state's help. And then other revenue they receive, so fundraisers, all kinds of different local efforts that might go toward helping the school district. Does this make sense to everyone? Because this is a really important concept that allows you to talk about school funding 101 with just about anyone in the state. If you get this, you get a lot. The legislature sets particular pieces of that they deem are worthy. And lately, what we've seen a trend creeping, which end of Jim Doyle into our current governor, is that revenue limits are being bought out entirely by state equalization aid. If they can't buy them out, they freeze them, which means that your school district doesn't get any extra expenditure authority in the classroom. On the converse, what we've seen in the last couple of budgets is that the equalization aid component is increased and the revenue limit piece hasn't. So what the end result of that is the property tax levy going down, but the important part, which is how much you're actually spending on your kids in your classrooms, has not changed, has not kept pace with inflation. In fact, has not changed. We can talk about problems with the aid formula at the end, probably. I think that the aid formula doesn't work very well either. It was based on an antiquated model that if you evaluate it based on whether or not it's doing its job, it's doing its job. Its job is to equalize property wealth. That's not necessarily indicative of whether or not your kids are wealthy or your schools are in need. The revenue box on the far left historically had changed to increase to keep pace with inflation. In fact, at one time, for nearly a decade, it was actually tied to the inflation rate. In 2010-11, there's a sharp spike downward in there. That is the $550 per pupil revenue reduction that was passed on to public schools during the first year of Governor Walker's budget, Act 32. Then you'll see a spike back up to the positive side. That was the joint finance action to add money back in that particular biennium. Then you'll notice that there's a creation of a separate piece, because that is a what they've labeled, the legislature has called, a per pupil categorical aid. So when we were talking about the formula, that is traditionally how schools have been funded by the legislature and governor for the past 25 years. The per pupil aid is a new creation that is a categorical aid that is distributed based on how many students you have in your district. It is not directly in competition, but competes with, in a funding stream, equalization aid, which is designed to help equalize a district's ability to pay. It's important to note that the increases that have happened in the past couple of years have been outside of the traditional way that we've funded our schools. During the Great Recession, Wisconsin schools lost educators, lots of educators, lots of experienced educators, which means that the ones that they're hiring back generally don't have the same level of experience, classroom knowledge, expertise. Not that that's a bad thing necessarily, but it is an important piece of this. All of these things have resulted in more reliance on local school district referenda. That's something I'm sure all of you guys have noticed if you read a newspaper. It's becoming a very common trend around the state. So not only have we seen an uptick in the amount of recurring revenue limit exemptions, which are a unique type of revenue limit exemption that allows a school district to basically spend on anything, school costs to maintain their facilities, but their pass rate is going up. So districts are realizing this is happening, communities are realizing this is happening, and taking action outside of what happens under the dome to fix it. The majority of the referenda that you hear about are to issue debt, so to build a building, things of that nature. The other two are for financial reasons. So a district is realizing that without some sort of intervention from the local community, they're not going to be able to provide the same level of education to their students. That's the easiest way to describe non-recurring, recurring, and debt. So, brings us to where we're at today, the 15-17 biennial budget request from the governor. Where the priorities of the state, generically speaking, are when it comes to dividing up general purpose revenue. General aids and categorical aids to public schools, okay? That's an important piece when you think about where in the past two budgets, now this particular budget, emphasis is being placed with money. So if you think about the fact that our schools represented 32%, and then you add in the school levy and first dollar credit programs as well, you're talking about a very large share of where GPR goes. And historically, if you think about the past few budgets that our governor and legislature have signed into law, that is eroded at that particular figure. It has not kept pace with the other programs' expansion. Now, full disclosure, a lot of that is due to the fact that medical assistance, that number two, has increased as well in a large form. But it is important when you think about where the state generally spends its general purpose revenue and where the state has done so in the past 6 years, which results in this particular figure, which was prepared by WISTAX, showing per student revenues for an average school district. So they looked at how much was spent across the state, looked at a per pupil level, and then broke it out in an aggregate. So this is not a perfect figure, it's an average, it's an estimate. Up until 2011, inflation was being adjusted with in our expenditures. 2011, the $550 per pupil cut, 16 and 17 being the proposed budget that is before the legislature right now. So you'll see that the 16 budget, actually, as I'm sure a lot of you know, is a reduction in the amount schools can spend by 150. And then going forward in 17, 165 would be added back. Important to realize, though, when you look at, compare the peak of 15 to the peak of 17, and you'll realize that that valley in the middle is lost expenditure, right? You can't go back and re-educate a first grader. So you have now just taken money out of that classroom in that 1 year, restored it in the second for a purely budgetary purpose. It's a shell game. So as we talked about at the beginning, there are a few things at the beginning of this section. There are a few things that are categorically funded by the state. So these are a couple of incredibly important categoricals because they tie into the beginning discussion that we had and the demographic change in Wisconsin, the rapid changes that are happening, and the fact that policymakers and the legislature have not reflected those changes properly. The students with disabilities. So we've known about students with disabilities for a number of years, obviously. The amount that we're funding them at the state and federal level is continuing to slip. All right? Now what that means, in the easiest and plainest sense, they're required to be educated by state and federal law. So if you pay for less and less of that education, it means it's eroding the classroom experience of everyone. So unless the state steps up and starts to meet the needs of these students, it's going to directly impact every classroom where a student exists with disabilities. Second one is our bilingual bicultural students. So students that are English language learners or are coming to us from another country. Funding continuing to slip. If I was to have a slide, which I don't, that shows you how many of them are coming into our schools, it is an exact inverse. So as more and more of these kids are coming, the state is not doing anything with its funding stream. That's somewhat different from our students with disabilities, which have kept pretty much a flat level and even declined a little bit in recent years. But their cost, again, this cost to continue inflation type thing that we've been talking about the whole time, has not been realized. And the amount of money that it costs to educate them is such that if you don't adjust for inflation, that particular reimbursement rate continues to slip. So it's somewhat of two different problems, but again, it's a reflection of when the real demographic changes that are happening in our schools aren't properly accounted for, you see these sorts of trends. So there are a couple of pieces of this budget that are helpful to our rural schools around the state. First of which is an increase in sparsity aid and high cost transportation aid. Those are two aid programs that are directly targeted to help districts that are small and rural and districts that have extremely disproportionate costs to transport their kids. Secondarily, there is an expansion of Teach 2.0, which is a program that helps schools with technology and tech learning. That is, by and large, though, federally funded. So the governor, in this case, decided that he was going to take federal money. So, but there's a lot more bad that we can talk about here, and this kind of opens up the discussion, which there is an incredible expansion of the voucher and charter program in this particular budget. State charter board that would be allowed to create what you and I generally do not refer to as charter schools. There are two our independent charter schools in the backyards of school districts and across the state. There are a couple of pieces that rein that in a little bit, but the end game is obviously that those pieces that rein it in will be removed as time goes on. Massive expansion of the voucher program. Obviously, you've seen that. No caps in the Wisconsin program. Funding mechanisms have changed. A lot of accountability pieces in here. So elimination of the Smarter Balanced exam after this particular year, which is the first year of its usage. State report cards and district report cards, or state and school district report cards, excuse me, would have massive changes to them, legislative oversight over them in areas that they have not had in the past, and they also lock them into statutory law. So we would not be able to reflect the kinds of demographic things that we've been talking about all today. Alternative licensure. Don't know if this one's yet got enough attention, but it is incredibly important because the governor has set forth in his budget a policy whereby any person with a bachelor's degree would be able to take some sort of test to become a teacher. No pedagogical experience, no classroom experience, no teacher training. You walk into a classroom, you take a test, you become an educator. And then, of course, major cuts to the University of Wisconsin system and one of our great partners, the Education Communications Board, who produces a lot of great content that your students or your kids or grandkids know and love. I'm not going to say Sesame Street because it's a national program, but programs like that that are direct classroom learning pieces would be eliminated. Now, one more thing before I turn over the reins to my partners here. I mentioned the funding aspect of how vouchers are funded. So in public schools, we look at all of your information, your statistics, your data, and we fund you based on how you turned out in our formula on the prior year. The voucher program, those figures, that 7210, that 7856, they report their enrollment in September, we give them the whole payment instantaneously. Then they're required to account for it. If a student leaves, we prorate that time. But the important piece is that these people are getting their money first. It's not coming out of our public schools right now. It would under this budget, but it's not coming out right now. But it does give them a competitive advantage in that they get that full 7856 for a high school student in September. Your public school district has to wait an entire year to get that funding. So, Yeah, it's an enticement. She's exactly right.
It's an enticement.
And we do pay them in checks over time, so in quarterly checks, but they get that, they're guaranteed that full payment at the beginning of the year.
And I'm going to focus specifically on what the governor has proposed for the next biennium in his two-year budget. The first thing that's important to know, and Tom mentioned this, is that revenue limits on school districts are frozen for the next 2 years. School districts' costs are not frozen. And I've gotten into trouble in the Capitol because I haven't been as full-throated a supporter of Act 10 as the majority legislators would like me to be. But the simple truth of the matter is many school districts, many administrators, many boards are saying, you've given us the tools under Act 10, but you haven't given us any lumber to build with. On the other hand, expenditures and indeed payment rates for voucher schools, for example, have increased, as have payment rates for so-called independent charter schools. And I'll talk about both of those in a minute. When revenue limits are frozen, any money that the state puts into general aids to school districts has to go for property tax relief. It's that simple mathematical equation that's written into our law that if the revenue limit is held constant and you get more money from the state, you have to pass that along to property taxpayers by reducing your levy. You don't get to spend more. So when you hear politicians in this budget talking about we've put more money in for schools, technically they can say that, but it won't allow a single school district to increase its budget or to spend more in the classroom. Now, in the first year, that's not an issue at all because there's no increase in general aid. We're frozen at the previous year's level. So what school districts are receiving from the state is more or less what they will get next year. There's always a little bit of adjustment because enrollments change, property values change a little bit, and our formula adjusts for that. But essentially, what they got last year is what they will get next year. Now, in the second year of the budget, there is a slight increase in general aid to schools. But again, it goes for property tax relief because the revenue limit is held constant. And you've no doubt heard the governor talk about wanting property tax levels in this state to be lower in 2018 than they were in 2014. This is one of the ways you do it. You put a lid on school district spending, you put a little more state aid into it, and that goes for property tax relief. The net effect in this budget is that you get a $5 decrease in the property tax bill on the average home in the state. Now, if you have an above average home, if you own the Wrigley Mansion in Lake Geneva, you get a lot more than $5 in property tax relief. That may not be a fair thing to say. I don't know if that's if that's still in private ownership or if that's been turned into a tourist destination. But as an example, the more the value of your home, the more the property tax relief you get. The big thing for schools next year is that they actually will, not only will they have no more state aid coming in under the general aid formula, they'll actually have a $150 per pupil cut. The legislature, for a variety of reasons, and I think I can explain them without getting myself into hot water here. We have, under our equalization aid formula, because we have not kept putting money into that aid pot, that pool of money, to keep pace with inflation, there are some property wealthy districts that are no longer getting very much aid, in fact get little or no general equalization aid. They are simply so wealthy that they've kind of fallen off the formula. And some of those are in Door County, Green Lake, with all those vacation and second homes around the lake, are examples of that. The Wisconsin Dells has so much property value per student. They get very little state aid. And so the legislature was trying to figure out a mechanism without increasing revenue limit authority to put more money into schools. And let me explain that. When you increase revenue limit authority and you don't increase state aid, the increased money comes from the property tax. Any time revenue limits are increased, in the first year of that increase, all of the money comes from property taxes. And it goes back to that little discussion we had about school districts having to wait a year to get their money under the aid formula. it takes a year for that to catch up under the aid formula, so that when you increase revenue limits and don't buy that down with increased general aid, all of that allowable increase in the revenue limits falls on the property tax. So legislators are somewhat reluctant to increase revenue limits when they don't have enough money to put into state aid. In addition, when you put money into the general aid formula, it's equalized so that wealthier suburbs get proportionately less. And where is control of the legislature these days? In wealthy suburban districts. So it's to their advantage to fund something that doesn't flow to districts based on their relative property wealth per pupil, but instead to do it on a proportional per pupil basis. And that's exactly what they did. That way, the claim could be made that every district got money. If you add money to general aid, it's distributed to districts on an equalized basis. What that means is, in general, the more wealthy a district is, the more property value it has behind each student, the less it gets in the equalization aid formula, and the more money gets channeled to property poorer districts. Now, if you're a legislator representing a suburban area that has high property wealth, or even, let's say, Madison or Middleton, that has relatively high property values per student, putting money into the equalization aid formula isn't going to get you a lot of property tax relief, because your district isn't going to receive very much in a proportional sense. By putting the money into something that is on a per pupil basis, your district will receive the same amount per pupil as any other district, which makes it much more politically saleable to the group of legislators that is governing the Capitol these days. And you can see that trend playing out here. Beginning in 12-13, the legislature created per pupil aid on a one-time basis. And the catch there, this was coming right after the big 5.5% per pupil drop, which translates to about $550, $560 per student. They said to districts, if you raise your revenue limit by up to $50 per student, and if you can do that, knowing that it's all going to be on the property tax, we'll give you $50 on top of that in a per pupil aid. So every district that agreed to raise its property taxes by $50 a pupil got some money from the state. That was a one-time only thing. It expired at the end of the 2012-13 school year. But then they came back in the budget 2 years ago, and the governor, it's not a surprise that he didn't allow the revenue limits to increase in the budget he just proposed, because 2 years ago he did the same thing. He's trying to hold property taxes down, and he provided for no increase in revenue limits 2 years ago. The legislature then came in and said, we don't like that. That's choking off our school districts, and particularly those rural small districts that are having declining enrollment. The revenue limit is calculated on a per pupil basis, so that as you lose students, you lose spending authority. The formula tries to even this out a little bit by using a 3-year rolling average. So you lose a student, they go elsewhere. You lose 1 year's worth of counting that student. In the second year, you've lost 2/3 of that student, and in the third year, you've lost that student completely. Thankfully, the legislature found additional money, and this is something that typically happens in April or May. Anybody have any idea about why the state might find more money in April or May? People file their income taxes. We know. And this was not a great year for retail sales. We know what the sales taxes, by and large, are going to be, because the holiday shopping season is such a big factor. We re-estimated our state revenues in January, and they're not going in the direction we'd like them to, at least not as fast as we'd like them to. So now our hope is that come April or early May, when we know what's been filed, and this is You used to have to wait because they'd have to hire hundreds and hundreds of people to process these paper forms. Now a lot of it's being done online, and we can get a much quicker picture of what's going on. So we should know whether revenues are keeping pace with the previous estimates, whether they're ahead or whether they're behind. We hope that they'll be a little bit ahead because there is support among legislators for doing something about that big $150 cut in the first year. And let me say something about that $150 cut that I think I've neglected to mention. Because revenue limits are frozen, districts can't tax to make up for that $150 per pupil cut. So it's an actual cut. It's a real cut of $150 per pupil. Now, you know, on a $10,000 budget, that may not seem like much, but if all your other costs are going up, teachers' contracts get renewed in April, so you've renewed all of your teacher contracts before the state finishes its budget process. You know what you're on the hook for in terms of those expenditures. This is all important stuff for school districts. So to get back here to my original thought, the legislature allowed a modest $75 increase in the revenue limit in both 2013-14 and 2014-15, which is the current school year. And on top of that, it provided $75 in the first year and an additional $75 in the second year. So that's how we get to that $150, those accumulated. And the way the legislature wrote that was to say it'll be an additional $75, and that $150 amount will be paid in 2014-15 and years thereafter. Well, the governor came by and basically erased the words "and years thereafter," and that's how we're getting that that cut. It stops at 2014-15, and then there's new language that would restore it in 2016-17. Now, what is the net impact of that? Wisconsin Taxpayers Alliance has calculated this. We have exactly $15 more per pupil to spend after the two-year budget than we did in the current year. So a $15 increase on a $10,000 per student budget. Not very much. The legislature also has lots of fun with something called the school levy tax credit. It sounds like it's money for schools, doesn't it? Sounds like it's school levies. That must be related to schools. Schools levy property taxes. But it has very little to do with schools. The only connection it has to schools is that it's calculated in each tax jurisdiction, in other words, each municipality in the state, on the basis of the proportion of property taxes levied for schools in that municipality compared to all the other municipalities in the state. The money is paid out, it appears on your property tax bill in December, and then it's paid out to the municipalities, who are the tax collectors, the following July. Why is that advantageous to the state? Well, we have a balanced budget requirement, and that allows the state to push that payment out into the next biennium, or into the next fiscal year. So if you're trying to make the argument that our state's books are balanced, you can arguably kill a couple birds with one stone. You can claim that you're putting money into schools, you can lower property tax bills, and you can defer the cost of that into the next fiscal year so that it looks like your books are more balanced than perhaps they really are. And the state has gone to this well a number of times, and it's going to do that again. The governor increases this credit by $105.6 million for both property tax bills that will come out in December 15 and in December 16. So there's money in the budget for schools, but I would say it's money in name only because it all, by law, goes to reducing property taxes, not allowing schools to spend any of that money. And you can see how the governor is accomplishing his goal of trying to hold property taxes down so that in 2018, according to his pledge in the last campaign, they will be no higher than they were or perhaps lower than they were in 2014. There is some money for rural school districts. I don't know how many of you in the audience are from rural areas. chances are in this part of the state there aren't many districts that will benefit from this. Sparsity aid goes to small rural school districts with enrollments of less than 725 students and a density of less than 10 students per square mile. Most of the districts that benefit from this are in the western, southwestern, northwestern, and northern parts of the state. The state had been prorating these funds, and it had first cut the amount of money in the program and then frozen it so that districts were receiving about $230 per student when they were supposed to be receiving $300. The budget fully funds that now, and you can do the math. $300 minus $230 is $70. So these rural school districts that qualify will get about $70 per pupil more from this aid in the next school year than they are currently receiving. But that is not enough to offset the $150 per pupil cut. They're still $80 per pupil short. There is a small increase in transportation aid for those districts that small increase in the reimbursement. There's not an increase in the amount of money the state is putting into the fund. For schools that transport their students the furthest. And there's an expansion of something called the high-cost transportation aid, which will benefit some rural school districts. If you transport students and your costs are more than 150% of the statewide average, you will receive this aid. Now, there was a little wrinkle in it last time. This was created 2 years ago. A number of suburban Milwaukee districts qualified for this aid, which was really intended for rural districts. Part of the reason is that some of the really high-toned suburbs in Milwaukee don't have sidewalks. They just have ditches alongside the road, and it was deemed hazardous for students to be walking in those areas, so the school district runs a bus. And so their costs, and they also have a lot of private parochial students that are transported for the very same reason. And so their costs actually were high enough that they got this aid. So the legislature said, no, that's not what we meant. We're going to exclude districts that have a high high pupil density from this aid. Interestingly enough, this was a recommendation of the Rural Schools Task Force, as was the preceding increase in sparsity aid. And the chair of that task force, Representative Rob Swearingen from Rhinelander, can't figure out a way to get Rhinelander into this aid program. It's frustrating the heck out of him. The governor is phasing out the Chapter 220 program. It's a program that dates back to the desegregation cases, I think the mid-70s in Milwaukee. It was a program to encourage suburban school districts that were not very diverse to accept students from minority populations. It's been criticized that it primarily targets the African-American population and doesn't address the Hispanic or Hmong or other populations. But mainly other districts around the state say, why are you spending all this money? Some of these districts are becoming more diverse. Districts like Brown Deer now are no longer as white as they used to be. They now are, well, yeah, they've hit the targets that the program was set to try and encourage in terms of desegregating schools in Milwaukee County. It was a voluntary program, and now open enrollment is available. So this will put, over time, it'll put a little bit more money back into the general aid pot, but not probably a lot. And then we get to voucher expansion. This is a very insidious plan that the governor has put forward. I'm not sure where to begin. Tom talked about the voucher program as it currently exists, and that program provides state funds, totally state funded, to low-income students and their parents to allow them to attend private and parochial schools. It's been deemed constitutional, although at the time the cases were heard, the checks went to the parents endorsed them over to the school, so arguably the state wasn't funding the schools directly. It was funding the parents, and it was their choice as to what to do with the checks. Now, in this age of electronic banking, the checks do actually go directly to the schools, and the parents sign an authorization that allows that to happen. The system for students already in the voucher system will remain in place, and they will continue to get those amounts fully paid for by the state. And those amounts are paid for from a separate appropriation. So over here you have the appropriation for general aid for public schools. Over here you have the appropriation for voucher payments to private schools. Guess what? That will remain for those kids already in the program, but now for new entrants to the voucher program, the money's going to come from over here, the general aid for public schools. And the way this works is that if you have a student in your district who enters the voucher program beginning next fall, the average aid money that you receive for that student will be taken away from your district and put into a pool of money along with all of the other districts that are similarly situated. In other words, all the districts that have residents of their district going into voucher schools, that money will be combined in the pool, added up, and distributed on an equal per pupil basis to the voucher schools participating in the program. Because of the way equalization aid is calculated and distributed to schools, this is a tax on poorer school districts. They're going to be paying proportionately more. You've got, I don't want to pick on them, but let's say Wisconsin Dells and Beloit. You've got Beloit that probably gets about $8,000 maybe in state aid per student because it's a property poor area. You've got the Dells that, let's say, gets $500. You get a voucher student from each district participating in the program, and they don't have to have ever attended or been enrolled in those school districts. Beloit contributes $8,000 to the pot. The Dells contributes $500. You divide that and you get, what, $4,250? And that's what the voucher schools would receive. Now, that's considerably below what they're currently receiving, so that it may serve as a little bit of a disincentive for them to be accepting a lot of students. We don't know. But Beloit, well, all school districts, but Beloit in this particular example cannot tax to make up for that lost aid. So it's just out that $8,000. Regardless of whether that student was ever enrolled in Beloit, was ever counted in the aid formula, was ever counted in the revenue limit formula, you get 100 students from Beloit entering a voucher program. All of a sudden, Beloit loses $800,000 with no way to make that up. Now, that comes on top of the $150 per pupil cut and the frozen revenue limit, which is why I say this is a very insidious plan that is going to erode the capacity of public schools to cope with it. Because there's a year lag in everything in the formula, this plan would begin to correct itself in the 16-17 school year. Those students who are counted against your aid, you begin to get aid for them. However, if the state isn't increasing the aid pot, but adding more students that are counted for aid purposes, the amount per student begins to go down. So every district in the state is going to feel the effect of students entering the voucher program, and the effects will be most severe on those districts that are the property poorest because they're most dependent upon state equalization aid, which is this pot of money that I've been representing here. I don't think this is very well understood. I'm extremely concerned about the precedent it sets to be taking money from the public school pot. This is an argument that's very popular. The money should follow the child. The problem, and people think about this simplistically, that you lose a child, you should lose expenditures. But that's not necessarily the case. If you lose one student from a kindergarten class of 20 students, you still have to educate the other 19 students. You still have to have a teacher in front of that class. You still have to light and heat and do all the other things, run the buses to get students to that class. Your costs don't necessarily go down, but if you're poor Beloit, you've just lost $8,000. Some thoughts.
There's a lot you've heard today, and there's a lot I could share with you, but I want to emphasize a few points on what you've heard about the proposals, and then I want to kind of pull it back to, you might say, 30,000 foot level a little bit, but to talk about really what's at stake and what we're doing. So what I wanted to show here, just to reemphasize a point that you heard earlier, this is an analysis I did on data from a year ago, what the proportion. And it shows you the same thing in terms of the number of schools and the proportion of kids who are there by virtue of a voucher. In other words, that we are funding as opposed to the private funding paying for their tuition. The first two columns are all the schools that participate in the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program. So this is Milwaukee only. A couple of years ago, the legislature removed the qualification that the private school that participated in the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program had to be in Milwaukee. So now schools that are in the suburban areas can participate in the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program as well. One thing to know is when this bill was first passed, when the program was first created in 1990, there was a requirement that no school could enroll more than 49% of its students by means of a voucher. That was removed in the mid-90s when we expanded the program to include private religious schools. At that level, notice how few schools would meet that level today. And in fact, if we look in Milwaukee, less than 10 that participate. And those two that are in the bottom level, the very small participation, that is Marquette University High School and Divine Savior Holy Angels. We have 18 schools that participate in the program that have no private funding paying for the tuition for their kids. And another 50 that are between 90 and 99.9. Which has prompted some to call these schools private in name only. The two statewide expansions of privatization that are currently proposed, and I want to talk a little bit more about that charter school authorizer board, because that, I think, is also, I don't think it's getting much attention, and I think that it actually could have very detrimental effects on the system going forward. I've been studying charters and choice for a very long time now. But in the voucher program, the statewide voucher program, you've heard already that they're going to remove all the caps, and I'm going to share kind of my graphic of thinking about how this is funded and why I think it's particularly insidious. I like that word. But in terms of the charter school authorizer board, there are 42 states in the country that have charter schools. We're one, of course. The majority of those states are like the way we are now, where the only authorizer or for the most part, the only authorizer is this school board. The school board gets to enter into a contract with a nonprofit group to run a public charter school for a set contracted period of time. That's the charter contract itself, which we usually just call the charter. They hold the charter for a term, and depending on the state you're in, that term has lesser or fewer years. 5 is the most common term for a contract. And the thinking behind this was, of course, that at the end of that 5-year term, if the school was not meeting its performance goals that are specified in that contract, in that charter contract, that then it could be non-renewed. And that would be politically easier than it is for a traditional school board to close a traditional public school that's low performing because of all of the political slings and arrows that then step up and say, wait, don't close our school, right? Well, we've learned now after 20 years of charter schools that those same things that say don't close our traditional public schools say don't close our charter school for the same reason. Now, we have closed charter schools, and charter schools do close, and fiscal problems are the number one reason that charter schools are closed. But right now, in the majority of districts, the authority to charter a school and to close a charter school rests with the school board. In a smaller number of states, and now proposed to be our state, there's some other entity. Now, in Wisconsin, we have long had what is colloquially referred to as our 2R authorizers. There are special authorizers. And so in Milwaukee, it was the Milwaukee Area Technical College, UW-Milwaukee, and the Common Council of the City of Milwaukee. MATC has never exercised its authority. The other two did. Now, it was limited only within the confines of the city of Milwaukee. They could charter schools, but only within the city limits of Milwaukee. And if they did, they're independent charter schools, which means they're funded separately. And in terms of the draws, and you two correct me if I'm wrong on this, but as I understand it, when they get ready to pay out the money for schools, the first draw is to pay all those two-hour charter schools. So all that money, $8,000 a kid, goes to those independent schools, and then whatever's left gets divided up with the school districts. So understanding that, then, every place in the state is paying a bit of the two-hour charter school because that's where all that money's coming from. And what that, of course, does, and that was added into the law because the legislature was expressing frustration with the Milwaukee Public School District School Board for not authorizing enough charter schools. Frankly, it was a completely unfair claim because at the time they made the claim, the school district was under court order not to charter schools until they could figure out how it attended to their desegregation issues and a variety of other things and the teachers' union and stuff. So dinging them for failing to authorize schools when they were judicially prohibited from authorizing schools seems a little bit unfair. But at any rate, that's what happened. And now what is proposed is the creation of this charter school oversight board, which is another misnomer if I ever heard one. And it would have the ability to tag any entity in the state, any nonprofit entity in the state, including a university, as an authorizer. And once that entity became a charter school authorizer, it could authorize charter schools anywhere in the state, regardless of what that locality wants. Regardless of whether or not the school board thinks it's a good idea, regardless of whether or not the voters think it's a good idea, it wouldn't matter. That charter authorizer could authorize as many charters as it wanted, and in fact, once it authorizes one charter, that charter can start many schools, more than one school even. And so that is going to allow all kinds of privatization efforts. These would all be independent because they have no relationship to school boards, no relationship to voters, no way for voters to influence what's happening either with the authorizer or with the school that is now a public school getting funds in that area. And of course, completely diminishes local control and thereby diminishes my vote as a voter in the current state of Wisconsin. I think that that's something that's not getting much conversation, but it really should. Is that fair that that's going to happen? And what's the justification for doing that in the first place? What do we know about charter schools that would suggest that this is, in fact, a good idea? And then just look at the proposed funding, because it really is, I think, horribly insidious. This is the way that I'm depicting it. So again, I know they had it as an equation. I'm really visual, so I think of it as my box, and the box, the different colors in the box shift. The revenue limits are my box, right? And so as state aid gets bigger, the blue part that comes from the local part of local property taxes gets smaller, and vice versa. And that's, of course, in recognition that property-rich districts can tax themselves little at a small rate and still get lots of money, whereas property-poor districts may actually have a proper tax effort. In other words, they're taxing themselves at a higher rate, but because they're taxing a higher percentage of a smaller overall number, it still yields a smaller amount of money. So that's what that equalization aid is designed to help to correct. The way we would fund this voucher expansion is that state aid would follow the student, as you've heard, and then be divided among. Then those rich districts, if you will, have much less that they have to make up. They're taking, if you will, a much smaller hit. That means then that the property poor districts have to absorb more costs for a child who is going to exercise a voucher. And to use a kind of crazy analogy, you can't, it isn't as simple as, well, I don't have that child to educate, so I save that money as a school district, because you don't. As you heard Dan say, you still have heat, you still have buses, that all costs the same. You still have to put a roof on. The roof didn't change the cost just because fewer kids were under the roof. You know, it's very regressive. You could even call it a bit Robin Hood-y if you'd like, except it's reversed. It's the reverse Robin Hood, where we're going to rob from the poor and hand it over to the rich. That also means that our urban districts, which tend to be our property poor districts, are going to be hit doubly. Why? Because that's also where more private schools are currently located. So they're not only going to have to make up more money and have a much harder time making up the money if a student exercises the voucher, it's more likely that they will have students exercising the voucher. The school district cannot tax to make up that loss, even though it's going to hit them very hard in terms of how they're going to continue to educate the children who are staying in the public system. So yes, we are giving people choice, but we're also reducing the choices of those who choose to stay in a public system.
Some thoughts.
You've been listening to a discussion on the effects of Governor Scott Walker's proposed state budget on K-12 public education. This is one of four talks sponsored by the Madison Institute titled The Wisconsin Budget Debacle. The other topics are University of Wisconsin System, Social Services, and Natural Resources. All are available at our website at themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the Madison Institute.